On this edition, we're talking about a fierce heart with meditation and Dharma teacher Spring Washam, and I'll play an encore segment of an interview I did with spiritual teacher Michael Beckwith. This is Journey's Fire. I'm so glad you joined us today. Before we get to my interview with Spring, first, here's a word from a few of our sponsors.
Elaine Voci is a life coach, a certified celebrant, and the author of 7 books. She officiates at personalized ceremonies, teaches workshops, facilitates death cafes, and writes a blog on her website, elainevoci.com. Elaine's latest book is titled Resilience Art, a grief coloring book using music and ritual to help you grow, and is written for anyone grieving the loss of a loved one, for family and professional caregivers, activity directors at assisted living centers, as well as social workers and other helping professionals. The book is available on Amazon.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
With stories from South Central LA to the jungles of Peru, these deep and honest reflections by one of the country's most powerful mindfulness teachers focuses on compassion as the fiercest and most effective response to suffering. Spring Washam is a founder of the East Bay Meditation Center, the most diverse and accessible meditation center in the United States. In A Fierce Heart, she shares her contemporary unique interpretation of the Buddha's 2,500-year-old teachings that get to the heart of mindfulness, wisdom, and compassion. She's joining us today from her home in Oakland, California. Spring Washam, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You know, when I read this was your first book, I couldn't believe it because you did good, girl. This is a great book.
Oh, thank you. I'm not really a writer. I keep telling everybody that, but I do have stories. So.
Yeah, and they're wonderful stories. Let's start with your story about how a girl from Long Beach, California became a shaman from the Amazon and a yogi from the Himalayas.
Well, that's part of that is kind of a joke, the Himalayan part. I've been to India, but I haven't been an actual yogi in the Himalayas. So.
Yeah.
Well, that really came from when I was in my early 20s and I first started to get into meditation practice. I spent many years doing long retreats. And so one of my teachers gave me the nickname, you know, Yogi from the Himalayas, because I was always on 3-month retreats or 6-month retreats. And at that time in my life, practice meant a lot to me. I was learning so much and growing and healing so much. And then about 8 years ago, I started, as a way to work with trauma and understand more about healing, I started going to Peru. So I have had quite a few adventures. That'll be my next book. It'll be more about the Peru Amazonian adventures.
Well, now that you've written the first one, I'm sure the second one will be much easier.
That's what they tell me, but I have a feeling it'll be hard for me. Because, again, writing is, I'm much more of a vocal communicator, you know, speaker than I am a writer, but I'm growing into it.
Well, not only was this your first book, but two people who you know well and lended their name and also beautiful words about your book, which is on the book, are Alice Walker and Jack Kornfield. Not bad.
Yeah, it's been a really amazing how many people, we're already doing a reprint. People have been loving the book, and it's getting, I'm going to be getting some awards or nominated for something here in the Bay Area. I'm learning more about that, but thousands of copies have been sold, and it's so touching. Somehow it's connecting, and I love that.
That's wonderful. Well, Spring, you grew up in a biracial home, your mom being white and your dad being African-American. Your family was always fighting about race, culture, and identity. How did this atmosphere help you cultivate your fierce heart?
Well, I think what's interesting when you grow up and, you know, between different cultures and within families that already have a lot of problems, when you add race into it and identity, I think what it did was it just helped me first understand that I can walk in different worlds in this life. And I think that has always been a part of my daily experience. I can be in East Oakland teaching a class to a group of people. Then I can move and be in Marin County, which is a very wealthy neighborhood, and outside San Francisco, and I can teach a retreat with a totally different demographic. So I think it's made me comfortable in a lot of different worlds and around a lot of different types of people. So on some way, that's been a good thing. On another level, it just what it did was it helped me to figure out who I was from within myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you grow, where is my voice? Who am I in this? What is my deepest connection and to these cultures and my own identity? So it does help you sort of pave the way within your own being. You discover, you know, who you are.
Yeah, yeah. You left home when you were, I think, 15, mm-hmm. to run away from your mom's abusive boyfriend at the time. Tell us how that changed your life.
Yeah, I think, you know, I left home. I had to. My mother was going to marry somebody that was abusive, and what that did for me was it, again, it sort of forced me to grow up quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, I always thought that I was mature, but when you're on your own, you learn a lot really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that learning is really the hard knocks. You just don't know anything when you're 15, really. And so, but what it did was, again, it sort of forged this sort of inner determination. You know, it sort of forged an inner strength. I became very self-reliant and responsible.
Mm-hmm.
And I just began to look for answers within myself, you know, and I began to think about the things that I cared about. And it also sort of forced me to look at the whole topic of suffering and what is suffering and why do we choose that? And, you know, because obviously at that time my mother was a very sad person.
Yeah.
And so that it helped me to look at that from a different perspective.
There seems to be an addiction to suffering.
Yeah, it's a habit. Mm-hmm. I think of it more as a habit.
Yeah.
You know, it's the habit of we pick it up every day and then we lay it down at the end of the night, or maybe we don't even lay it down at the end of the night. You know,
mm-hmm.
we keep it going 24/7. But I think it's just a habit, and what I realized is, you know, in my teaching and travels is people don't know any other way. They learn that, they see that in the culture, and they don't know another way. And so part of the reason to write this book was to present another way, to offer people a lifeline,
yeah.
a rope, or some kind of different message that would be relatable to them.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine a lifeline for you is when you found Buddhism. What age were you?
Yeah, I was about 20, maybe 24, 23, 24, I went on my first retreat.
Okay.
That was Buddhist-based.
Yeah, and why did you decide that was the right path for you?
Well, you know, I didn't even know when I showed up at the retreat that it was Buddhist or who was even leading it. I started off practicing on my own in a Hindu tradition and reading books from, like, the book Autobiography of a Yogi,
kind of
a classic book.
Yeah.
I read that and other books, and I started meditating on my own, but I wasn't getting very far, and I wasn't doing very well. I basically would sit there and think about all my problems. So it dawned on me one day, I don't really know if this is meditation. And I started to think that I need a teacher. That thought began to arise in my mind. I need a teacher. I need to learn how to do this. And, you know, this is almost 20 years ago. There wasn't all the meditation apps and YouTube videos and all the stuff that we have now.
Right.
There wasn't even that many books. So I heard about this retreat happening in the desert, and it was 10 days for beginners. And all I knew was that they give you vegetarian food, and they teach you how to meditate, and it's in silence. And I just knew if I could get there, all my questions would be answered. And so I drove to the desert, and that became a very huge retreat, because I met Jack Kornfield, who became, you know, my dear mentor, friend, and I learned how to practice, and it was there that I heard the Buddha's teachings for the first time.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of stories over the years from people who had abusive homes, let's say, and maybe they even left home at an early age, but they took them a long time before they started making the right choices. Have you ever looked back on your life and said, what was it about me that fairly early in your 20s, you ended up on a great path, actually?
Yeah, you know, people ask me that a lot, and I don't know, it was just something as a small child, and I write about that in the first chapter of my book, that even when I was 5 years old, I looked at my sister and said, wow, this is going to be a tough life. And I was looking at my parents, obviously, the situation, you know, where we were living. I don't know, I just think it was something within me that just had this very strong desire to understand, and I think it was this innate compassion that I had around observing people and the pain that I would see and their response to that pain, acting out on others or fighting or hurting each other. That observation of that had a very profound effect on me as a young person. I really wanted to understand, why are people behaving in this way? Mm-hmm. Why is it so hard? Why are people intoxicated? Why are they abusing each other?
Yeah.
And so this led me, I would say that question really motivated me.
Yeah, and it sounds like at an early age, perhaps before you even knew it, the calling of Dharma teacher was starting to unfold within you too. Interesting.
Yeah, that's also really interesting. I think if I would have been in another culture at another time, I would have been one of those young people that would have really resonated. Like if you go in Asia and other parts of the world, you know, children ordain in monasteries and get Dharma teachings very young. I think I would have been naturally drawn to that. You know, I had to learn a few things, you know, and here we are in this more modern time in California. But,
yeah,
the Dharma teaching, it just flowed from out of my care. I've always just wanted to help.
Yeah. Well, and one thing we all have in common, and you write about this in one of your chapters called The School of Life, that we are all enrolled in the School of Life. And as you write, it's always in session.
Always. That I do know. Never a dull moment.
Yeah. One of my favorite Sufi poets is Hafiz, and you quote him in this chapter. You say, Hafiz says, you carry all the ingredients to turn your life into a nightmare. Don't mix them.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of people are these days. Buddhism is about 2,500 years old. How do you fit these teachings into a modern context in lifestyle with your meditation and Dharma teaching?
Well, I think that's an ongoing question all the time. And I know when we, here in Oakland, we opened a meditation center 10 years ago that was all on donation and learning to translate these teachings into people's lives. You know, somebody who's a single mom with four kids and, you know, people that are like, I need help. And they needed something very practical, very relative, relatable. And so what has happened over the last few years is teaching in these different communities, so, you know, one from a very scholarly perspective, and then coming down into an urban community and applying it, has helped me to try to translate, which are very simple fundamental teachings about the nature of life, into everyday experiences, and to give those teachings in a way that people understand them.
Yeah.
Because when they hear them, they know it's true for them.
Yeah.
For those, they go, oh, yes, I recognize that, yes, my mind suffers like this too. I'm attached, I'm caught, I'm angry, I'm emotional. It's not a hard understanding. It's just sometimes I think teachers overcomplicate what is very simple, actually, simple truth.
Yeah. Can you share a few personal stories to help explain some of these teachings?
Well, I think a lot of the what's in the book is really was 16 chapters that I really tried to unpack in a way of these profound Dharma nuggets into bite-sized pieces that were applicable.
Yeah.
So I think one of my favorite chapters I write about is a chapter called Hello, Goodbye, which is about impermanence and letting go.
Yeah.
Now, we see that everywhere, but we don't always understand it as a very core fundamental aspect of the Dharma. This is something the Buddha talked about, this things come together and then they naturally fall apart again. It's the nature of reality. And so I wrote that book, Hello, Goodbye, talking about a story in that book to try to make that a relatable teaching. Like, you haven't done anything wrong. It's just, it's ending now.
Yeah.
Right? And to take teachings that are innately in us, we get it, but it's just pointing it out in a clear way, in a language that speaks to those, is, I think, what needs to happen for the Dharma to move out into different cultures, younger people, different perspectives. It can't be isolated in kind of one pocket of society.
Yeah. Yeah, I've always been fascinated by that teaching, impermanence. To me, it's a beautiful word and a beautiful message. It helps us when we embrace it and flesh it out on our daily lives. It helps us keep from holding on so tightly to everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, when we accept that, oh, this is the way things are, there's less suffering when things change.
Yeah.
You know, we can relate to it differently. Doesn't mean it won't hurt a little bit, but we can hold it in a much bigger view.
In one of the stories you write, another chapter heading in your book, you talked about the way things are, and it's remember who you are. And you know, in that teaching, in all the world religions, is so huge. You write in that chapter that, of course, Bud means to wake up. You talk about we're really like that, but our radiance can be obscured. Meditation practice is to uncover the jewel in the heart of your lotus, to wake up. Would you say waking up is probably the biggest thing we all need to be doing?
Yeah, and I think the word waking up is a good one. And also lately, I really like the word remembering who you are.
Yeah.
That these good qualities are in us, this beauty is in us, we know it's there. And, you know, life has a way of sort of caving in on us and our experiences and our relationship and our family and our troubles. They can all create these clouds that obscure this natural beauty. And so we just need space to remember, time to remember. So that's what I like about retreats, is like helping everybody remember who they really are.
Yeah. Yeah, you could almost say it's really not about spiritual or personal development. It's about remembrance.
Yes, it's not about perfecting ourselves. It's just about taking off the layers of confusion, letting them fall, and having the opportunity to keep investigating.
Yeah. In this book, you say that we need to embrace it all, even the most painful aspects, to cultivate a fierce heart. How do we start to embrace it all without feeling overwhelmed?
Well, that's a great question. I think the most important thing is to really start where you are. Because sometimes people think they have to get out of their current situation into a different one in order to practice spirituality, right? If only I, you know, had a different job, if only I had a different partner, if only I had a different neighborhood, if only I could lose 20 pounds, I could do yoga, if only, right?
Only,
I hear that a lot. I need to change, then I can practice. And I say, no, the practice is right here, right now, wherever you are, is the perfect situation to wake up in. And it doesn't mean it's going to stay like that. If something needs to shift, it will. But we use this moment, you know, in the middle of what can feel like insanity, to embrace this as the present moment experience. You know, you could start a practice right where you are if you're in a, you know, low-income housing in Detroit, or you're in a wealthy neighborhood in Georgia, wherever you are is the perfect place. So that's kind of like we just start to open to our life with embracing the moment. Okay, here it is. It might be sorrow. It might be things are a disaster. But what I've noticed on the path and what I've noticed, you know, over the last 20 years is often people have their biggest wake-up when things are hard.
Yeah.
You know, it's like in 12-step, they always talk about hitting rock bottom, then mm-hmm. the breakthrough, or, mm-hmm. you know, and that rock bottom is hard for a lot of us. It could be when we're in our worst moment that there's this breakthrough. And so that's kind of what I'm pointing to. We know it, but it's good to remember it and articulate it, because sometimes mm-hmm. when we're in our worst moment, we lose sight of there could be no good in any of this, you know?
Yeah, and all the great mystics and all the world religions seem to have a sense of that, didn't they? Rumi.
Yes.
You know, when he said, out beyond the right doing, the wrongdoing, there's a field, I'll meet you there. There's something beautiful about that.
Yes, there's something that could say your heartbreak could be, you know, your biggest breakthrough.
Yes, yes.
And it gives us a lot of hope when we're in that place where we feel that there's just darkness, or we're overwhelmed with pain, or we're in, you know, we have an illness, or, you know, that we just have to remember that as we go through these things that they make us stronger. Something is waking up, and we can use those difficulties in order to make really positive changes.
Absolutely.
If we're paying attention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Spring, why is forgiveness such an important aspect of cultivating a fierce heart?
Well, what I've come to with forgiveness, and it's an ongoing practice. Oh, my goodness. It's never a place where I've arrived and that's it. Right. There's always a new person, a new situation, right?
Yeah.
It's like life gives you a thousand ways to bow and forgive, right?
Absolutely.
All the time, whether it's your relationship or your dog chews your shoe up, whatever it is, you got to practice this if you want to live with peace, right? You want to live with how life is, reality, right? And so I talk about this all the time, because what I've noticed is that when people cannot forgive, they can't move forward.
Hmm.
They can't let go. They can't grow. And so when I started really working with forgiveness as a practice, internally, externally, with teaching forgiveness in the community, what it allows us to do is to finally let go of the trauma that has haunted us, or we begin the process of letting go of the pain. Part of the habit and the addiction comes through resentment, comes through, I'm going to hate this person forever.
Yeah.
So that part of it is the gripping on, usually, is gripping on to something that has happened that we can't reconcile.
Mm-hmm.
And we just relive it over and over.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, forgiveness has been a huge way to move forward, to let go, to begin again, to what I'm forgiving isn't about the person necessarily. What I'm forgiving is confusion.
Yeah.
You know, that's really what I'm looking at. Only a confused person would hurt another person, thinking that that would make them happy.
Absolutely.
You know, it's the height of delusion. And so that's what I'm working on forgiving, is confusion. I'm working on forgiving greed, hate, delusion. Not so much the person in that moment, just the consciousness of that.
Yeah. Yeah. The state you live in, California, has been hit so hard recently with natural disasters, from the forest fires to the mudslides in the Santa Barbara area. I have some friends who live there, and I'm trying to track them on Facebook. There's so many people, though, are experiencing compassion fatigue also with all of the recent natural disasters. And worthy causes asking for help and contributions, the hurricanes that we had earlier. Do you have any suggestions of how to stay mindful and compassionate in that?
Well, you know, I agree with you. It's just one thing after another. So a couple things I have to say about that. Also, what's, you know, happening in California is happening all over the world.
Right.
With fires, mudslides, environmental, different things that are happening on the planet. And so one of the things that I like to talk to people about mostly is to do self-compassion.
Mm.
You know, because our compassion is not complete unless it includes ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the big problem which leads to compassion fatigue, is that there's so much energy going out and not enough coming in. Like, to my own heart that feels broken, you know, that's maybe I'm out there serving, but I'm not also tending to my own heart in that moment and comforting myself. So in Oakland, where a lot of the programs that I teach are many caregivers, teachers, social workers, activists, they're already in a caretaking profession. So when I teach compassion, it is fundamentally self-compassion. Because I think if we can fill our own cup up enough, the heart can hold all this suffering.
Yeah.
It can. Its function is to be able to hold it. But it can't do it without compassion.
Mm.
And that has to be for ourselves as the one who's feeling all of the emotions. You know, if I'm suffering, the first thing I do is try to meet that with compassion. I care about this pain. I care about how difficult this is to bear witness to
mm-hmm.
all this suffering.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard on all of us to watch others lose their homes or die or drown or, you know, lose everything in fires. You know, this could be us at any moment.
Yeah, absolutely. Know? Absolutely. Or we watch way too many shootings take
yes,
place, not only in the world, but even in our country. Exactly. And with that comes people who not only need to learn self-compassion, but unfortunately a lot of people who've been touched deeply by those events are also now walking through their own grief issues. And you talk about a grief ritual. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, I think, at different stages in our lives, we experience natural cycles of grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very influenced by an African teacher I had. Her name was, she just recently passed away, maybe less than a year ago, Sabanfu Sime. And I was interested in working with her. We would do grief rituals, which was in the African tradition from the country of Burkina Faso, West
mm-hmm.
Africa.
Uh-huh.
And she was kind of a shaman, and she wrote many books on grief. And she traveled all over the world leading grief rituals, places where maybe a plane had just crashed. She would go into that community and lead a grief ritual, or just travel throughout the United States. She moved to the United States and started doing these grief rituals. So I learned a lot about her, from her, about grief and how healthy it is to allow grief to express itself and to kind of honor it. Now, honoring it doesn't mean we feed it. That's different. We want to honor it because it's natural for us as human beings to go through very deep cycles of grieving as we let go of one stage of our life and move into another. Maybe we let go of people that we love who have passed away, parents, children, family members. The inability to allow ourselves to grieve fully is a sign of sickness in a culture. This is according to those in West Africa, especially in Burkina Faso.
Mm-hmm.
So every period of 8 months, a year, the leaders, they would sense the grief in the air, and they would say, okay, now it's time for us to have a grief ritual. And they would build these shrines of forgiveness, because a lot of times grief comes from a lack of forgiveness, and they would build an ancestor shrine, and then they would build a huge altar, and people would put their grief on the altar symbolically as a way to move forward. And then they would let themselves emote whatever was there, whatever the body or the heart or, you know, and so, you know, that's a very elaborate grief ritual.
Yeah.
But I think what's practical for us is there's something sacred about going through a period of grief, you know, to honor our limitations, to not try to medicate it away, to not suppress it. There's a healthy amount of tears that we all have to shed on this spiritual path, and it comes with being human. And so I worry sometimes that people try to shut that down prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then it doesn't have the flow of a real letting go experience.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit more about the East Bay Meditation Center, your founding member and core teacher there, and also can anyone come to a class there?
Yeah, so the East Bay Meditation Center is really great. It's a center in downtown Oakland, and it's open to all beings. We have a lot of different types of affinity groups and courses there, and but anybody could come. They can look on the website, eastbaymeditation.org, and I teach there all the time. We do programs, classes. We have a lot of different what we call affinity groups. So we have groups for teens, children and families, people of color, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, two-spirited communities. We have all kinds of groups, and so we call ourselves a refuge for all beings. And so for all the communities here in the Bay Area, which is so diverse, what we try to do is just offer programs to meet the needs where everybody is in their life, however they identify.
That's great.
So it's a very multicultural center that kind of celebrates the rainbow, you know, in some way.
That's wonderful. You know, there's a lot of talk about mental health also in our news. I'm wondering, how do you take care of your mind as well as your body? Because that also helps one cultivate a fierce heart.
Well, I really do what I really practice what I preach, and I could do it a little bit more. One could always, you know, practice more meditation. I don't ever think there's too much, and especially in this time, that these times we're living through right now. But I do. I have to be really, really conscious of what comes in. You know, I don't have a television. I try to stay away from a lot of news programming, shows like that. I try to exercise every day. Mm-hmm. I eat really well so that my body is optimal. I try to take very good care of my body. And then I try to take very good care of my heart. Because, again, It's my heart that can hold everything.
Yeah.
And so I do a lot of practices where I focus on compassion, self-love, presence. I try to spend a lot of time in nature.
Mm.
And I try to surround myself with a lot of positive people.
Yeah,
I think that's really, really key, is who you're around. You will be influenced by. And I try to focus on the good. So much of our lives are focused on what's wrong in the culture. But for every one terrible thing that's reported in the news, there's 1,000 beautiful things that aren't being reported.
Yeah.
And so I really intentionally seek out good stories and positive movement and people getting better and healing and letting go of fear and opening their heart. And so I try really hard to focus on that. It's not that I negate what's happening. It's that I just create more of a balanced view.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love this book. It's
that's so great. Thank you.
Very well done. The title is A Fierce Heart, Finding Strength, Courage, and Wisdom in Any Moment. And so can you share your web address for us, please?
Yes, they can find me. Just Google springwasham.com.
Well, Spring, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today. And I love this book. I'm going to get the word out as much as I can to other people.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. And I loved being here with you. I appreciate that.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
Would you prefer to learn that your body is asking for help before the issues could be identified as a disease? Thermovision Clinical Thermography is applying the science of thermographic analysis to assess body's health risk factors. Thermography helps to monitor our health as well as the effectiveness of a chosen healing protocol. Thermal imaging is non-invasive, no contact, no pain, and no radiation. A totally safe test of body functionality. All other tests can only detect structural damages that are already detectable and measurable. To learn more, go to Thervis.com.
Hey, welcome back to the program. Back in 2010, I had the good fortune of bringing Michael Bernard Beckwith and Ricky Byers Beckwith to Indianapolis. We rented out the sanctuary at St. Luke's United Methodist, and he taught on spiritual liberation. That was the year he also had his PBS special on. And what a great guy he is. This is a segment of that interview that I did a few years ago now with the great Michael Beckwith. Michael Bernard Beckwith is a founder and spiritual director of the Agape International Spiritual Center. He's author of the award-winning book Spiritual Liberation, Fulfilling Your Soul's Potential, and originator of the Life Visioning Process. He's appeared on The Oprah Show, Larry King Live, Tavis Smiley, and his own PBS special, The Answer Is You. Michael is a sought-after meditation teacher, a visionary, and has won numerous humanitarian awards. Michael, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my joy being here with you.
I was excited about your PBS special, The Answer Is You. I'd like to ask you, it's been playing all over the country. What has the response been?
Response has been good. I've been getting a lot of mail, and then, of course, a lot of individuals are trying to inquire as to how to continue to practice what they've seen on the PBS special.
Mm-hmm.
And the book and the DVD, of course, will be released nationally this November.
Yeah.
But I think people are very excited, and one of the things that excites me is the fact that people are starting vision parties in their home.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Because one of the things I said in The Answer Is You is that turn off your television and tell a vision. And so I started getting these emails from from some youth groups who were once a week turning off their television and coming together to tell each other their visions and to support each other in making those visions come true. So that's kind of like spreading now, where people are having television parties rather than watch television. They're telling visions.
Well, I love that, and having vision parties rather than tea parties.
Right. I love that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, in the special, in your books, you talk about heart sets and mindsets. Can you explain that to our listeners?
Absolutely. I broke those up in terms of the mindset are things that we believe.
Mm-hmm.
Consciously or unconsciously. And the heart set are the things that we have deep feeling for. It's not just what we believe, but it's actually gone to a level of conviction on a heart level. Many people believe things. They'll say, do you believe in God? Yes. Do you believe in love? Yes. Do you believe that you stand in a field of infinite good? Yes. Now, they may have that as a belief, but it hasn't really moved into the heart yet, where it's become the law of their being.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, it may be there a part of their mindset, but it hasn't yet become a part of their heart set,
mm-hmm.
that inner conviction.
Absolutely. You know, in your book, Spiritual Liberation, I think it's in the introduction, you wrote, an enlightened society can only be created by awakened beings. Can you talk about that process of what it takes to become an awakened being?
The interestingly enough, when an individual begins to walk in that direction, they begin to want to know what awakening is. They begin to establish an intention to walk in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically tapping into that awakened part of them that is trying to express itself. And once an individual begins to say, yes, this is what I'm about. I want to grow. I want to unfold. I want to wake up. I want to become the highest and best that I can possibly be. The questions that they ask become different. Their priorities shift, and interestingly enough, what they need for them shows up. It'll show up as a book. It'll show up as a class. It'll show up as a TV special.
Mm-hmm.
It'll show up, and generally speaking, it'll also show up with principles and practices. It'll show up with the practices of meditation, becoming mindful,
mm-hmm.
that you can begin to think about what you're thinking about. It'll show up as affirmative prayer, not merely begging and beseeching a reluctant deity, but basically getting in tune with the fundamental harmony of the universe. It'll show up as a way of doing visioning. It'll show up as a way of beginning to shift the subjective beliefs so that the external world is not governing our destiny, but our own interior awareness is. So I think the first thing is that people have to become interested. And then once you become interested, as I stated in the book, you have to want this eventually more than a man whose hair is on fire wants a pond of water.
Mm.
there becomes a fire in the belly, so to speak, mm-hmm. where we really, really, really want this. And then the universe cannot help but give it to us
yeah.
in ways beyond our wildest imaginings.
It's really the difference between being a traditional warrior, we certainly know about that in this world, but also a spiritual warrior. And again, somewhere in your book you talk about, and I love this, that surrender is the stance of the spiritual warrior.
Absolutely. And when people are locked in their egoic positionality, mm-hmm. surrender is not a good word. It feels like you're giving up, you're acquiescing to something. But as you begin to unfold spiritually, you understand that the power is in surrender. And you're not surrendering to something outside of yourself. You're surrendering to the next stage of your own evolution. You're surrendering to the next great gift that wants to express itself through you. You're surrendering to your higher self. So you're actually yielding to something within you that wants to come out. You're surrendering to the next stage of your own unfoldment.
Mm.
And so it's a powerful stance. So instead of being willful, you're being willing.
Yeah. Evolution is such a beautiful word. You use it a lot in your teaching. You're also one of the founders of the Evolutionary Leaders. Talk about the fruit of one who is evolved. What does an evolved person look like?
Well, an evolved individual, the spiritual fruitage mm-hmm. is a dynamic peace of mind, a sense of well-being, a divine awareness that we are on purpose, we're not accidental, that our life isn't a que sera, que sera. You know, it is a purposeful existence. And you grow into a level of patience. You grow into a level of compassion. You grow into a level of creativity. These qualities start to loom large in your life. You don't necessarily stand out as looking special or a Superman or a Superwoman or anything, but these qualities of being begin to be more evident in you, and life takes on a different hue.
Mm.
You live in this world like everyone else, but you're living from another paradigm.
Mm-hmm.
There's possibilities around you, there's potential around you. There's openings for you to be of greater service. The acquisitive appetite of getting starts to fade, and now there's a generative, compassionate, giving, creative vibration that begins to take over.
Absolutely. Well, it is more about giving. I know you say, and I believe this is somewhere on your website, that your philosophy of living is simple. Life is love in action, and part of that is racing to see who can forgive first.
Absolutely. One of the things we do cover in the book, and those are the kind of, if we want to use the word competition,
mm-hmm.
and those are the kind of competitive games we enter into. Instead of beating your opponent down and having victory over somebody,
mm-hmm.
You race to forgive.
Mm-hmm.
You become aware there's an old statement about nobility, you know, isn't being better than the next person. Nobility is really being better than your previous self.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're always evolving and unfolding. And again, it takes a tremendous amount of strength and evolutionary verve to take a stand on forgiveness, particularly when someone has done you wrong or you think they have.
Absolutely. I'd like for you to talk about that, because you also share how we should be experiencing life as a celebration rather than a problem to be solved, and I totally agree with that. You've done international peacemaking around the world. Your church reaches out to thousands upon thousands of people in need. How do you, as an individual, strike that balance of service in caring about the ills of the society, but also keeping that peace of mind and knowing that, hey, it's time to celebrate and be joyful?
Absolutely. I've been walking that paradox for a long time, you know, because I'm known for saying that life is good. I'm known for saying, you know, life is a celebration. Let's join it. The entire universe is in celebration. Let's participate. At the same time, there's some issues that people are going through. You know, people are suffering. There's poverty. There's disease. There's war. There's all manner of things in the world. And so you learn how to strike a balance between the absolute awareness that life is eternal, no one dies, every soul is unfolding. At the same time, there's real suffering that goes on in this human incarnation. So as we grow in compassion, the question that we ask is, you know, how can we serve and alleviate suffering?
Mm-hmm.
And that's compassion. Now, that's different from sympathy. Sympathy means I'm going to vibrate the way a person that's vibrating that's in pain. I'm going to have a sympathetic vibration with them. We don't sympathize. We don't empathize. Sympathy says, I know how you feel. Empathy says, I'll feel for you. But compassion is different. Compassion is staying in the vibration of celebration, of love, creativity, and asking, how can I serve? How can I alleviate suffering? Mm-hmm. So I'm not getting in the ditch with an individual, but I am reaching a hand and pulling them out into a higher vibration.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what assists is spiritual practice. There has to be a time where you stop and meditate and contemplate the virtues, contemplate the eternal presence,
mm-hmm.
or you'll get caught in the muck. And if you go too far into life is hard until you die, you become depressed, burnout. Burnout activists, if you go too far to the other side, life is eternal, then you won't be any earthly good. You just say, well, everything is fine, nothing's wrong, I won't do anything. You know, so you have to have the balance of bringing the eternal into time. And that's a day-to-day practice. I don't think it's, one day it's done. It's every day. You know, something will I'll see something and it'll trigger something in me and I have to do my inner work and then I ask, how can I serve? So it's a day-by-day thing.
When I first saw you, and I believe it was on Oprah when I first discovered who you were and had heard about you before, but one of the things I've always been struck by you, and then having meeting you at WFYI when you came here to Indianapolis, was not only the great wisdom that you teach in a very inspiring and passionate way, but it's your humility. And sorry to say, it's rare oftentimes these days to see that. I'm wondering, Michael, who have been your teachers along the way who have spoken life into you?
Well, there's a man by the name of Dr. Homer Johnson,
mm-hmm.
who was in his late 80s when he passed over, that was a great mystic, who I used to go over to his house on Saturdays and sit and listen to him and just ask questions, and we would pray together and meditate together, and he was a great teacher. And it really gave me some energy that I was headed on the right path. There was Dr. Howard Thurman, who I had a chance to meet when I attended Morehouse College. I stayed in Thurman Hall, as a matter of fact. And so he was a great teacher. It was the first lecture I ever heard when I went to Morehouse College. And even though I was only about 17 or 18 years old at the time, it made an indelible impact on my soul. That then later on, as I grew, I was really receptive to his teachings. There's a Walter Russell, the great American mystic, who just mastered so many things in his life. Great mystic. He was a great scientist. He predicted the new elements on the periodical table before they came out. He invented the duplex. He was an ice skating champion at the age of 69 years old. He's a multimillionaire. Had a tremendous cosmic experience. Studying him let me know I wasn't crazy because I had an interesting breakthrough spiritual experience. And then when I read his book, I saw that he had something very similar, so it let me know that I wasn't alone.
Mm-hmm.
So he was one. George Washington Carver, another great mystic. Sri Aurobindo.
A lot of people aren't aware that George Washington Carver really was a mystic.
Yeah, a lot of people are incorrectly informed. They think that he was merely a scientist.
Right.
But he was a scientist basically proving what he saw in his mystical visions.
Mm.
He would wake up 4 o'clock every morning, go outside and talk to nature. He would talk to the flowers, and the flowers would tell him what their use was. Then he would go into his laboratory and prove what they had told him. So he was getting it firsthand from God through nature, then proving it in the laboratory, but oftentimes the books only recall what he did in his laboratory, but they don't tell you where he got it from originally. As a matter of fact, I have a picture, 2 photographs of Dr. George Washington Carver right here hanging in my office, right over my shoulder right now. He was a great mystic. As a matter of fact, he's also known for, at that time, he trained many of the great spiritual teachers and ministers at that time. They would come to him at night because he was an African-American man and it wasn't proper at that time for a white man to be taught by a black man. So they would sneak to his home at night. And so a lot of the great ministers at that time and the great teachers were actually George Washington Carver's students.
Wow.
But they could never admit it because of the segregation at the time.
And they were showing that hunger that you were talking about earlier.
Right, absolutely. So you have Ernest Holmes, who founded, of course, the Science of Mind. But there's a lot of people. You know, interestingly enough, you asked me that question because I was doing a radio TV program recently out of Canada. It's called Visions. And the first question the man asked me was, first of all, they were interviewing all these icons from different walks of life, actors, inventors, great singers. I mean, these are really big names. And then I saw my name on the list, and so I said, well, you know, you're interviewing me, why? And he said, well, you're Michael Beckwith. You founded Agape. You wrote this award-winning book, Spiritual Liberation. You've done this, you've done that. We know about you in Canada, of course. We're going to come interview you. And so his first question was, how do you remain humble after you've done all of these things, received all these humanitarian awards and written all these books and all of this? That was his first question. And what came out of my mouth was, I live between the radical tension between being and becoming. I embrace who I am. I embrace the insights that I've had and the tremendous gratitude that I'm able to be in a position to share them. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I know I'm not yet what I'm going to become.
Mm.
So I live in that tension between who I am now and what's unfolding. So that keeps me in a beginner's mind space where I'm always available to new insights, new revelations, new ways of serving and being myself. So it keeps me just open and receptive. I'm like around here they call me a perpetual child. You know, I'm just always open. You know, to something new. I don't really live so much from memory of what I know. I'm just kind of in the moment and always available. So I think that's akin to humility. I know there's a great power. I'm in tune with it. Yet I know there's way more than what I know about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just try to stay open.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have very potent and powerful people around me.
Mm.
So so with those potent and powerful people around me, there's, you know, I just lean on this invisible presence, and we work together to make a mighty difference on the planet.
And I've often found that my children can keep me humble as well.
You know what?
You have two children. I was wondering what your children have taught you along the way.
You know, I was going to say that. I have a number of people in my life. My mother, my wife, my daughter, my son, my grandkids, and I'm just Michael.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I always have to live up to whoever I'm at whoever I am in that second. I can't live off any past glory. It's like.
People who have met you, I think your mother also on some teaching cruises and such, says she is just absolutely adorable.
Yeah, she's adorable, and she actually she's always on a high state of learning herself. You know, I've learned. She's close to 80,
mm-hmm.
78 or 79. I don't know. I have to figure out the math. But
mm-hmm.
she's learning something every month, every year. She's always involved in something. She doesn't. She refuses to hang around with people who are old.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking chronologically.
Yes.
You know, I'm talking about people in their thought pattern.
Absolutely.
You know, she will hang around a 30-year-old or in a minute.
Mm.
If that individual is creative and progressive and has something to say, and she won't hang around with people 60 or 70 or 80 if, in fact, they've grown old and have stopped learning. So I've learned that from her. My daughter, she reflects back to me the teachings, and she grew up like this. And it's fascinating for me to watch her think like this so naturally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she wouldn't even call it spiritual. I mean, she does know it's spiritual, and she does come to Agape. But because it's so close to her, there's certain things, certain habits that she has that I watch adults have to learn these habits. Whereas she just, you know, she's about to start a new project. She calls her friends over. They have a vision. They have a vision process. They do it. They write down their visions. They write down how they are going to work on themselves to embody them. There's just certain things that they do that she's grown up with, you know, and she has courage, and mm-hmm. she started a new business, and it's doing well, and she acts. I mean, I watch her manifest, you know.
That's beautiful.
It's a powerful thing, you know. They're great kids, you know. They're funny.
Yeah, 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 yeah. That's wonderful. I'm wondering, do you have a particular daily practice that you do as far as your own spiritual walk, or does it depend on the day?
No. I there's certain things that are boilerplate, and then I add to it. Now, every single day, when I'll wake up and enter into a moment of gratitude for being alive, and take some precious moments to center and meditate. And then I go to the gym. I'm with a trainer, and I work out every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I come home, I make my famous green shake that I drink, and I go out in my backyard and put my feet on the ground. And I do some Qigong and do some breathing exercises, and I meditate.
Mm.
And that's like my basic.
Yeah.
And then depending on the time, I'll add my yoga practice.
Mm-hmm.
I'll add extended meditation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'll layer on depending on the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to get out of my house on any day without stopping and having a moment of meditation and prayer.
Yeah.
It's never going to happen. People, and that's why I never try to have really early morning appointments,
mm-hmm.
because I have a certain routine that I do, and I don't get tired of it. It's just like when people wake up and they know they're going to brush their teeth and take a shower and do certain things. That's a part of my thing. It's just these certain things that I do, and I would feel naked if I didn't do them.
Yeah.
So when people try to have really early appointments with me, it really has to be real important for me to do that, because that means I'm going to get up earlier to do some other things that I have to do.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah. Well, that inner work of heart that you're talking about, inner work of spirit, really is what leads to the big work out there. It's essential, and it's really about discipline too, isn't it?
Yeah, I call it a blissipline. I like the word discipline, but a lot of times people, they have a negative connotation around discipline. They think it's negative.
Yes.
But actually, discipline is when you love something, there's a natural discipline that revolves around it. If you have a spiritual teacher, and you love your teacher and you love what's coming through them, you notice that your life would begin to gravitate around a certain discipline. You'll wake up, you'll listen to your teacher, or you'll do a spiritual practice. And so discipline really comes out of the word love. It's not hard and I got to make myself do this.
Yeah.
No, you're actually embracing something you really want to do. So I'd call it a blissipline.
I like that.
Because it actually a number of years ago, maybe 15, 16 years ago, I coined that phrase. So I was actually walking down an aisle about to speak, and I was in a very expanded state of awareness. And I was getting closer and closer to the platform to speak, and it was just, I could just see for miles. And I heard the voice say, and it was a sweet state of bliss.
Mm.
And this inner voice, the ego, said, uh-oh, this means something bad's going to happen after this. You know? And I caught the voice and realized that we live under this illusion that if things are getting really good, that we naturally assume things are going to get worse.
Yes.
And so so as I got up on stage, I talked about the need to have a blissipline, that is to develop the inner structure to maintain the bliss and to be able to participate in greater flows of energy and to train ourselves. So that's what we actually live for, higher and higher states of bliss. And that doesn't mean frivolity, blissing out, not doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just means a really strong connection of happiness and the activation of our potential.
Yeah.
The other thing that I teach is bliss is actually a function of the activation of your potential.
Yes.
Well, I had two great teachers on today's program. How cool is that? You were listening to an encore segment of an interview I did with Michael Beckwith, and what a treat it was to have meditation and Dharma teacher Spring Washam on today's program. Her website, again, is springwasham.com. And that's it for us. Our website here is richardbrendan.org. All shows are podcast on that site. And so for engineer Christopher Shoulders and production coordinator Angel Richardson, we're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.